Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition of the program, reminding you to reach out to all the veterans in your life this weekend and thank them for their service to our country. I told you we'd hear from three different World War II veterans in three different states. Fort Benton, Montana is where we met Durrell Gibbs. Since our interview, he's been inducted into the Montana Cowboy Hall of Fame. But the most gripping part of his story goes back to his days in combat on Okinawa with the 96th Infantry Division.
I'd done my watch and I was trying to get a little shut-eye, and Sergeant was standing there doing his watch, and all of a sudden, I was just being walked on, and I was hearing him grunt, and a Jap soldier had crawled up, and it was a hand-to-hand situation. I come up out of that hole. Well, there was two of us, and it was pretty dark night. That Jap, he died right there. Laid him off the side of the hole, and we spent the rest of the night. The next morning, real early, we was going to move out, and I seen that that Jap soldier had a pistol, so I wanted, it was always for souvenirs, so I wanted to get that pistol. While I was taking that pistol off of him, he had a wallet up here on his jacket or whatever they call him, in a pocket, and that wallet was really protected. It had heavy cloth and cut fancy. That wallet surprised me, and so I was getting a pistol. I just put that wallet in my pocket, and we was moving out, and I never thought any more about it.
But he brought it home, and to understand how that wallet would end up changing many lives, we need to bring in Durrell's son, Wes. And let's start with this. How old do you think you were, Wes, when you started to understand that your dad had served in World War II?
Probably the earliest days of being a little boy and playing outside. My brother was 3 years older than me, so we were good buddies, you know. And I mean, when we were 4, 5, and 6, we were playing Army and playing outside, and Dad had a little suitcase that he brought back home with some things from the war inside there. And so we were always kind of looking at that stuff. And, you know, back then playing war, Mom had gotten us a couple of little Army helmets, and, you know, that was a big deal for us. And somewhere in there, I became aware that Dad had been a soldier, and I was really proud of that, really excited about that. You know, soldiers were all heroes in my mind, and to know that he had done that. So, yeah, I would say 4 or 5 on up.
Did he ever tell you much about what he'd done over there?
No, you know, I always wanted to know more, especially when I was 10, 11, 12, you know, a teenager. Dad would share some incidents, but usually they were incidents of funny things. You know, I wanted to know more about particular battlefield incidents, but he never did share too much of that.
And what are some of the things you remember being in that box that you got to play with or explore?
Well, I remember there were some of his medals, awards in there, and you know, my brother and I, Dad also had a trunk with his uniform, and, you know, I'm sad to say now, we wore those things around, and he kind of knew we were wearing those, and unfortunately, they didn't get saved. I still have his dress hat, and I remember there were some photographs from the war. There was the wallet that he's talked a little about. He didn't try to keep us from looking in there, but he always made sure that we, at least on that item, kept it special. We weren't allowed to play with it. We could look in it. I remember from the earliest time that we looked in it, the photographs were in there that always caught our attention, and there was a piece of Japanese money, some currency in there, but the pictures I remember mostly.
And did he tell you what it was or how he got it, or was just this kind of mysterious wallet that you knew you were supposed to be careful with?
Yeah, you know, I think all I knew at the time was that he had taken it from a dead Japanese soldier. So probably I was a young adult when I fully understood that. But we knew back at that time that it had come from a dead Japanese soldier, and even back then he had expressed interest in knowing more about that family and possibly getting it back to the family of that soldier. And it just boggled my mind how, first of all, you know, how he would think that that would ever be possible and why he would want that to happen. I just couldn't quite grasp that.
So Wes says he had a hard time understanding why you thought it would even be possible to reunite this wallet with the family, or why that even mattered to you. Can you help us understand that?
I don't know why it mattered. It was over a period of years as these kids were growing up, and here's this wallet with pictures of kids that he had on them, and the way the wallet was, it wasn't just stuffed in a pocket. The way he had it, I could tell that that wallet meant a lot to him. That's why I took it to begin with. Well, I didn't even think. I was taking the pistol, the wallet was there, and it was outstanding, and I just put it in my pocket. It was a slow process because I didn't think anything about it then. And when I got home, the pistol got stolen in a couple of years, but the wallet was always down there in the box. The wallet was always there. Nothing happened to it. Why? I didn't have anything. The other things was all gone. And as the kids were growing up, it just slowly dawned. And I knew I could see all those pictures of those kids. And I thought, well, here, my kids are growing up. I wonder what kind of family that soldier had. And where it was as personal as it was, that made all the difference, see? And yet, I thought how great it would be if that wallet went back with that to that family. But there was no chance of that. You know, I wasn't going over there. Wes always wanted to go, but the opportunities never arose. That's why I think the Lord, there was too many things had to happen for that to happen, and I think the Lord had a hand in it.
So when did this really start to take shape? When did it go from this idea that's out there that, yeah, that would be nice, but there's no way, to, hey, something's happening here?
Well, yeah, a little before, in my 30s or so, when Dad and I would get together, and I'm a history buff, and, you know, I would try to talk more about his war experiences. I just had a curiosity, wanted to know more, and kind of heard the same stories we'd heard as kids. But then one time Dad was visiting me, and I got on my laptop computer, and I discovered the 96th Infantry. I started just doing a little research. 96th Infantry had a website, and there were some photographs on the webpage of some recent trips by veterans back to the battlefield. And I just became just obsessed almost with the fact that I would really like to go back. You know, I was aware of another incident where a man that I had become aware of had traveled back, and just how meaningful that seemed to be for him. And so I guess it was two parts. I wanted to take Dad back and thought maybe he would like to see that area again. And then I just really wanted, before anything happened to Dad, to be back on the same places and maybe hear some more stories and hear stories that I hadn't heard and experience that with him.
Had you ever thought about going back to Okinawa?
No. I didn't see any way that I could possibly go back to Okinawa. I was really concentrating on building a ranch, getting a ranch paid for. Then opportunity just come out of nowhere. Wes can tell you about the opportunities, you know, because we were able to get back, but it was nothing that we could have planned.
What I thought was pretty interesting, though, every time Dad and I would get together, and my mother had passed away, so when Dad and I would get together, you know, we'd talk about the possibility of ever going back. You know, he always brought up the fact that he'd like to try to get that wallet back somehow to whoever that soldier's family was, and so that always kind of impressed me. And so probably about 10 years or so after I really began to feel a strong desire to somehow make that happen, the guy that I worked for at the time, I had a lot of frequent flyer miles built up, and I was always sharing with him incident stories of my dad, sharing with him the desire that I had to take him back there and go back with him. So lo and behold, here Christmas of 2010, my boss at the time, Andre Giles, says, "Hey Wes, I want you to have these two round trip tickets to Okinawa for Christmas. You go do it. You take your dad and you go back there." It just floored me. We didn't quite know what to expect totally. The Japanese interpreter had told us, you know, Japanese protocol, don't touch her. You know, she's going to be standoffish. You know, we just didn't quite know what to expect. And we landed in Japan, and NHK was there to meet us and get us in our hotels. And Dad, I don't think he got any sleep. you know, that night. The next morning, we were going to take the bullet train and meet Hojo's daughter, and he was so concerned about what the reception might be. We just still didn't quite know. You know, nobody said, she's excited to meet you. She's agreed to, and that's about all we knew. And so the next morning, a quick bullet train ride from Tokyo to Morioka took place. And I want to mention, Dad's an old cowboy, and so he wears a Stetson hat. And he had his white Stetson on, and so the media was aware we were coming. And even in Okinawa, people on the street would honk and say, "Cowboy," and everybody knew his Stetson hat. Well, we got to Tokyo, and, you know, we were the only guys walking down the street with a guy with a big white Stetson. And so everybody knew him and knew what our mission was. And we arrived in Morioka. They wired Dad up for sound. NHK was going to film this meeting. And we were informed that Hojo's daughter, her name was Noriko Kikuchi, you know, that she'd had a rough life, but she was kind of retired now and lived in a small home. And as we unloaded the van and walked up this path to her home, everything was nice and neat and clean. She had made a sign and pasted it to the door of her home that said, "Welcome, Mr. Gibbs." And instead of not wanting him to touch her, she kind of rushed to Dad and took a hold of his arm. Just held on to his arm. We were following kind of behind them in a little entourage of media. So we all entered her home, which was maybe half the size of this room we're sitting in right here, but very neat and clean. She had some fresh fruit there for us and a low table. We all knelt around that little table. So we had an interpreter. She couldn't speak English, and of course we couldn't speak Japanese. She was just very exuberant. And then as we knelt down, it seemed like she was a little bit subdued. And Dad presented her this wallet and the contents, and she took it out. And the interpreter, Dad relayed some of the information about the circumstances that he'd obtained it. She asked him if her father was alive when he first saw him, and Dad said yes, and she said, "Was he dead when you last saw him?" And Dad said yes. And then she asked, I thought, a pretty important question. She said, "Were you both fighting for your lives?" And of course the answer to that is yes, you know. And she seemed content to me. Did you get that idea, Dad? She seemed content to know that that any one of them could have lost their lives. She seemed content in the knowledge that it was kind of every man for himself, I guess, at that point. She seemed content in that. The discussion got around to each man was fighting to stay alive. That was the words. Each man fought to stay alive.
And I know there's something else that she said that held deep meaning, but I want to ask you, Durrell, when you're walking up, what's going through your mind? Before you see that sign, before she comes and grabs your arm, what were you thinking?
Well, the day before, I started thinking how serious we was going to meet the Japanese soldier's daughter. She was 2 years old when he died, and all she ever knew about her dad was what she got from her mother. You know, she don't remember at 2 years. And here, the soldier that was partially responsible for her dad's death, I say partially because there were two of us in that foxhole. Here she's going to meet the guy that's going to give her dad's wallet. Was the guy that had a hand in her dad's death. For me, I wondered what I should say. Like Wes said, you don't want to show any emotion. That's what Alex said too. He said, don't show any emotion or anything like that. Well, how do you go through something like that and not show emotion?
So when you saw that sign in English saying, "Welcome, Mr. Gibbs," and then she walks out and reaches toward you, yeah, and grabs your arm. Can you help us understand what that felt like?
Well, it relieved me because I was free to show what any emotion. She was showing all kinds of emotion, and I did too. Wes did too. All of us, it was an emotional situation.
And to be able to take this wallet that you've had for 66 years and hand it to her, what was that like?
Well, by then, after quite a few hours a night and part of a day, being stressed on how I wanted to do things right, but how was you going to do what we had to do and not show emotion? See, all of a sudden, all that was released because she showed the emotion, and then we was relieved. We knew Well, we was going to show emotion anyway. I mean, you don't do things like that and not show any emotion.
And the envelope that you'd never been allowed to open was opened.
Actually, Dad had opened it a little before then to kind of see what was in it, to satisfy his curiosity. And he'd always told us he felt that it was probably a sweetheart's hair. You know, that's what a U.S. soldier would do.
Yeah, sure.
And didn't quite realize what those short hair clippings were until the research group then filled us in. But Dad was very careful with it. And
I opened it, and the minute I seen that short hair, I just closed it up. The whole thing was, when she opened it, there was a fingernail there in the bottom. I didn't know that fingernail was there.
She laid out a piece of tissue paper, I think, on this table in front of us, and she carefully poured out the hair and the fingernail and touched them. And, you know, it was just very, very emotional, thoughtful. She carefully put those back in the envelope. And, you know, and their beliefs, I think I explained that before. She said to Dad then, I can't remember right if it was right then or just a little while later, a few minutes later, she said to Dad, "You've brought my father home."
And, Durrell, what was the biggest takeaway for you from this whole saga?
Well, before, when I talked about they were Japs, and all of a sudden, I can't do that anymore. They're Japanese. We found out they have the same problems we have. They have 3 meals a day, hopefully. They have a life of their own. They're Japanese. Suddenly, it don't seem right when I say the word Japs, and that's just the way it is. And that's how people can change. Hate can do a lot of damage, and something has to happen to heal it. So now they're Japanese.
I have a marvelous picture of my sister and her together, and I thought that was really, really a touching picture, because here's two daughters of these two soldiers, you know, at the soldiers that met on the battlefield, and here's the two daughters side by side. I just think it's been a tremendous amount of closure for both families, you know, a meaningful way to move on and find peace. And so I think we were helped to accomplish that, and that people who want to accomplish something like that will be helped along, whatever the situation and circumstances might be.
And perhaps there's a parallel there in the story of one of the veterans in your life. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, the kind of survival story that just defies any reasonable expectation. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.